Just being complacent, just thinking everything's going to be fine, it's all going to be there, just trust the system and do the right thing, that's a really bad idea.
Do your research, figure out what makes the most sense. You will land on Bitcoin if you research diligently enough.
It's weird that you could buy Bitcoin and useless coin on the same platform, but like, should you treat them the same? Should I treat Fartcoin and Bitcoin the same?
The air you should be putting into your life raft is not government hopium. It's Bitcoin, it's health, it's education, it's all of these important things.
Money is the way in which we view value. And once that medium of exchange, the way we can value something, once that begins to break and crack, you see these weird things happen. And people, you know, people start to get desperate and they wonder, you know, what's going on.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Wyatt Woodson. Wyatt is an Army veteran and an entrepreneur, awesome guy, very interesting conversation. This discussion is the wake-up call for millennials in particular, but really anyone still sitting on zero. My design for this was to be something you could send off to friends and family who are not yet aboard the Bitcoin life raft. So I hope it is useful to you and that you enjoy my conversation with Wyatt. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Wyatt here with me. Wyatt, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Awesome. Thank you for having me, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, this will be a fun conversation. This is we're going to cover a lot of topics, but I think this is going to be a call to action for a lot of people and hopefully a very useful tool for people to send to friends, family, particularly within the demographic that we're going to discuss, you know, that we tend to be a part of, but also to others who have not joined the Bitcoin life raft. So I want to start with this notion of generational urgency that you and I discussed offline last week. And you feel like there is a wake up that needs to happen, especially in this millennial generation. We've got a lot of life to live. And how do you think people should be thinking about trusting the system, you know, and just going along with what sort of has always been done, the conventional wisdom of today?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Michael. Trusting the system is really interesting. I think, you know, I am an Army veteran. And one thing that we have a problem with that we have to like really squeeze out of people is the complacency kills kind of situation with people in general. People will always trend towards being comfortable. They're always going to trend towards the things that aren't very painful. And, you know, the complacency is a funny thing because it's kind of a double-edged sword. One of the things in my life that was really formative was the 2008 recession, the Great Recession. And before that, I almost don't even remember. I was 16 at the time when that happened. I almost don't even remember anything except for just having a great childhood. And right when I hit 16, all of a sudden, you know, in Southern California, it was like this cataclysm. All of a sudden, people were nervous at my high school. I knew people whose parents were struggling or got laid off. And it was really hard to watch. And that's like it's a funny complacency thing because you go along your whole life trusting, you know, what everyone else is doing. Everyone else seems okay. But in that moment, you know, in like the 2008 crash, for example, everyone's trusting the system, everyone's going along and everyone seems fine. And then like a light switch, something happens. And then all of a sudden, everything is turned on its head. No one knows what to do. No one has any answers for anything. You know, you're walking around all of these adults, right? I was 16, all these adults, no one had any answers. They were scared themselves. And that's something that we deal with in the Army, which is just that complacency. Because the funny thing is when you take the safe road, people don't really fully grasp, and it's just, maybe it's like a psychological protection thing, but people don't really grasp that when you take the safe road and you do the same things over and over and you trust what other people are doing without any like thought into that, that is a bet. What you're doing is gambling. So, you know, people might look at Bitcoiners and say, oh, well, they're gambling on this internet money that is brand new, or, you know, it seems scary or something like that, but they don't realize that they're betting too. They're gambling too. The complacency that they have to just go along with things is a bet on the system still functioning. It's a bet on, you know, maybe someone at the top has convinced a bunch of people that it's safe to do this one thing. And, you know, in Southern California at the time, it was safe to put, you know, the vast majority of your wealth into your house. And that wasn't a safe thing to do. And the complacency of just, oh, we'll just get a bigger house. We'll get a raise and then we'll get a promotion and then we'll buy a bigger house and therefore we'll be wealthier. That was just accepted. No one thought twice about that at all in California. No one still thinks about that. Prices are crazy there. People always talk about it. There's always articles about it. No one thinks twice about that. And I and my family have already lived through that. So that knocked us into reality a little bit. But I think that the main, like going back to first principles is the complacency kills. You can't be complacent. You got to, especially, you know, in our age bracket, if you're a millennial, which is that's now the largest cohort of Americans are millennials. If everyone thinks that they're just going to go along for the next 20 years, like their parents did, they're going to be in for a rude awakening because they're just going with the flow. And people have to be really deliberate. You know, we have a lot of life left to live. Like you were saying, we've a lot of life left, you know, so we have 20 years of working, retirements, pensions. People are thinking about that stuff right now in our age group. And just being complacent, just thinking everything's going to be fine. It's all going to be there. Just trust the system and do the right thing. That's a really bad idea. It's a really bad idea.
Yeah, I love that way of framing it because people look at what we do in Bitcoin and, you know, putting so much of our net worth or all of our net worth into Bitcoin. And it feels like this big risk because it's, you know, 16 years feels like a pretty short history to have relative to the S&P or to obviously gold or things like that. But to me, the more I learn and dig into the macroeconomic picture, the more I understand history, the way money works, the way money's historically worked and been adopted, the more obvious it seems to me that we're on the right side of this. And the hard thing, and again, what I hope this podcast does is wakes more and more people up to that reality. It's interesting that you said as a 16-year-old that the 2008 financial crisis was so formative because I was 18 or 19, and I think my dad owned a small software company and he was set to, I think he was going to sell his company on like a Monday and then kind of everything hit the fan on a Friday.
Wow.
And they pulled funding for all sorts of deals and everything and it fell through. He ended up selling it, you know, 8-9 years later. But I think I was at a stage of life where I was so focused on school, college and everything going on that, I hadn't yet experienced the implications of what had happened. And I wasn't like, I feel like if I'd been 4 years, 5 years older, it would have been more formative because I would have been hit with the layoffs or I would have seen colleagues being fired or what have you. So it's interesting that you were so attuned to that at a young age. Is there a reason you think that was? Or are you just like a sort of a, like, do you just think differently than other people? Are you kind of a contrarian or what was it at 16 that made you pay attention?
I think I am naturally a contrarian for sure. But the real like slap in the face, the real jerky moment was just, you know, I was 16. I was already on the internet. I was already, you know, like a lot of people playing video games, but I was just very aware of what was going on. And I was very in sync with just trying to find out like the truth of something, the reality of things. And I just remember there was like a moment when, you know, Ben Bernanke told the Treasury Secretary, I think it was Hank Paulson at the time, that there'd be no economy on Monday if they do not bail the banks out. And I remember reading that as a 16-year-old and I was like, no way. There's no, like, it seems fake. Like it's just something kind of like Tony from the Bitcoin way too, where it's something that's so radical. It's like your life is one way one day, and then your life's just another way another day. Because I read that and, you know, people are pulling up in their driveways and putting in park and people are walking around going into the 7-Eleven and the dude in charge of our treasury is being told that there will not be an economy. You know, this is so fatal that we will not have an economy on Monday if they don't do something so radical that it was, you know, so necessary. It was just crazy to me. As a 16-year-old, it was like this dude saying that the whole country is going to collapse if they don't do something. And everyone was just walking around, you know, and being in SoCal, everything's all chill. Being in LA, everything's all cool and chill, right? But that was just nuts. That was nuts. There's so much uncertainty. And I think just going back to what we were talking about, it forced everybody, at least me and my family, forced us into reality. It forced us to confront that you can't be on cruise control. It's not the 80s. It's not the 90s. It's not even, you know, the end of the 2000s was basically like someone said, there's a fatal blow to our country. And if we don't do this, everything's going to explode. And that I was already a contrarian, but that took me to the next level of like, okay, so these are just people. They're just human. This is just a system. And if something's wrong, it can blow up. It absolutely can. And not that you have to be, you know, an insane conspiracy theorist or something like that. And, you know, I'm not that way. You don't have to think everything the government says and does is the exact, you know, opposite of the truth. But you definitely got to think for yourself. And if something sounds wrong or something's off, or for example, Bitcoin, you know, I've never met a Bitcoiner that's put in 100 hours, 200 hours into Bitcoin and hasn't come away a Bitcoiner. And it's just one of those things, like you got to think for yourself. If the system seems off, it probably is. And if you put 100 hours into learning about Bitcoin and it seems like this is a revolutionary, almost a discovery, then it probably is. And people should just trust themselves to, you know, I always tell people, especially after being in the army, people have to give other people a little more credit, to be honest. I know the NPC memes and all that stuff, but you sit down with your average person one-on-one and you talk, you go through something like Bitcoin, you can get through to a lot more people than I think everyone on the internet kind of cynically doesn't think that that's possible. So yeah,
I mean, I'll tell you what, I completely agree with that. I've always been sort of a curious person, always been a contrarian, but I was also, prior to Bitcoin, very hard-coded in certain beliefs that I thought would never change in my life. And as I've gone down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, you can imagine many of my fundamental beliefs on the way the world works and the way the world should work have just been completely upended. And if that can happen to someone like me, who was like, I was just like the quintessential right-wing conservative Republican type of guy. And not to say like all of my values have completely shifted, but like my interest in politics has been completely eradicated by going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and my faith in politicians, certainly. So that's an important point to make, is that even though we do, I was an NPC just sort of operating on this, like this prescripted, you know, life. And I think that's what a lot of people are doing, but I think the right nudge in the right direction can make a huge difference. We just need to, meet people where they are. And I think for someone like myself, it's easier for me to explain that to someone like, hey, I used to think this, and now this is what I think. And I would have never guessed that delta between what I used to be and who I am now could ever exist, but it does. So I like that. That's an important point you raise. So you've alluded to it. What's the advice then for like this 25 to 40, 45 year old cohort of people, the millennials out there? How should they prepare for the future?
Yeah, I have this analogy that I use a lot in a lot of different ways, but I always think of yourself, especially if you're our age and you're a man, you know, so past your 20s, right? Past the girlfriend, not very many responsibilities. Once you start getting responsibilities, a wife, a kid, a house, stuff like that, you're supposed to be thinking about the future. I have this analogy that I use where, you know, you're like a boat at sea, you're your own boat. And the more people, you know, a wife, kids that you bring on to your boat, these are responsibilities that you're taking on. You got to keep your own boat afloat. That's my That's my analogy. Is you're going out to sea. There's going to be great days where it's awesome out. There's going to be days where it's storming and it's crazy. And you have to keep that boat afloat, because the reality of the situation, and obviously Tony knows this really well, is no one's really going to come and save you. And my message to the 20 to 40 year olds is that's a really serious thing. If you make a major decision that messes your life up, no one's going to come and bail you out. That's not really a thing. And if you set sail and you're 30 and you're getting your life moving and you're 100% bought in and trusting the system and essentially delegating the safety of your boat to someone else or to some nebulous person in charge, you know, that's only good for as long as it lasts. You know, it's you're trusting your safety. You know, it's like letting fate take the wheel. It's like letting this nebulous someone else, this nebulous other, take the wheel to your boat and just start sailing into wherever it wants to go. And I really want to impress upon people to be deliberate, to be conscious, and take an active role in their life. You know, not be a passive observer. You know, every single person, as much fun as we do, you know, as much fun as we poke at the NPC meme and all this, everybody's in control of their life, 100%. And everyone really needs to be aggressive, I think, especially now. You know, it's like I was saying, it's not the 80s, it's not the 90s. Like, now is the time. It's late in the game. Everyone needs to be aggressive about, you know, if you got debt, pay that down, pay that off, whatever. Like, it's time to kind of get on board here and take control of your life, because there's more storms coming, and they seem to be getting more serious. And even though I think it's a good thing to not focus on politics, because I think it's a big distraction from Bitcoin, people just need to have their eyes open. It's time to stop kind of being on cruise control and really be focused on your family and making sure that your boat stays afloat, man. Your company, your family, you know what I mean? And if there's a storm coming, you got to be like ready. You got to have a plan. You know, it's no more cruise control.
Yeah. So part of the way you backed into this, to the answer of Bitcoin, is, you know, you talked about, like, during COVID, the U.S. printing 40% of its entire money supply in just a couple of years. To the people out there who aren't clear on, like, the value proposition of Bitcoin, or are still earlier on in the journey, what is that event of COVID and the money printing tell you about what's coming for the dollar, the future of savings, and so forth?
Yeah, that was a big turning point for me too, because before that I was into Bitcoin and crypto, you know what I mean? Going through that phase, unfortunately. And to me, that was like the nail in the coffin, because it was just like, dude, it was exactly like the 2008 problem. It was like a light switch. It was, you know, I remember it super clearly. It was, everything was fine. COVID, something's happening. And then a tsunami of money and people getting checks and stuff happening that you never thought was going to happen in your life. Never thought would happen. And when people think about, you know, putting their money, you take 10 grand to a bank, right? What you're kind of doing is giving the bank like a perpetual zero term loan on your money. And at worst, you're sort of giving over 250 grand, right? Everyone knows FDIC, right? Everyone knows, oh, the bank, which is sort of insured by the Fed, they'll bail you out over 250. That's basically like an informal security. That's like a credit default swap. That's what that is. And you have like this viper kind of clinching on everybody, which is you have to put your money in a bank because you have to pay for things, okay? But they have this ability to print money on demand out of nowhere, unilaterally, without your input, without our decision. And you have these informal securities at the bank, which is like it is a credit default swap, because anything over that, they're not insuring you. So you just have these like, it's like a twin, it's like a twin pincer move on your cash. If you're holding cash, they can devalue it and they're not insuring it above a certain amount. So it really forces you to think very hard. If, like, again, like if you're 30, you're 35 or 40, what do you do with this cash? What are you going to do with this cash? You're finally starting to make money. You need to invest for your family. You need to invest for probably your kids' college. You're saving for the future, for retirement, something like that. What do you do with your money? What do you do with all this extra income? Because the banks, they're not going to insure above 250 and the Fed can print it. So you have to, like I said, you have to be aggressive about having a plan. Are you buying, you know, what's the plan here? Are you going to buy gold? You're going to buy Tesla stock? You're going to buy bonds? You're going to buy some foreign stock or something like that? And I think when everyone, you know, let's say someone took my advice seriously and got aggressive about what do I do with my hard-earned money, my cash, my life energy. I go to work, I put in the time, I have my life energy. What do I do with it now? They're going to come to the conclusion that they have to put it in Bitcoin. I almost don't even see a an alternative, you know, and some people might say gold or something. That's kind of, it's kind of inflation neutral. But COVID to every adult should have been a gigantic wake-up call. And it should have been that frantic moment again of like, oh my God, I have to focus. What do I do with my money? They can just print it. So they can cut your money, your purchasing power, all of those hours you sit on the freeway, all of those hours you go to work, they can just destroy part of your life, your life energy. And I just, I think anybody that seriously looks at how to conserve their life energy for their family and stuff going into the future, they're going to settle on Bitcoin. They're not going to settle on Dogecoin. They're not going to settle on some weird stock or something like that. It's not going to take very long for them to yank it all. And just like I know a lot of Bitcoiners where it sort of goes from, oh, I'm curious about Bitcoin to like your whole net worth is in Bitcoin. I think that's what will happen to the average person when they seriously consider what to do with their income and their extra cash that they're trying to hold on to, because you don't want to lose it.
So the interesting thing is, I think for a lot of people who are experiencing this, like the constriction that you talk about, is it doesn't even, they know that there's some problem. It feels sort of ethereal, like they know everything's getting more expensive, life's getting harder, culture's deteriorating, but they aren't quite clear on how to pinpoint what hole do we plug to fix this. And my sense is that part of the reason for that is because of the a lot of the early FUD of Bitcoin, a lot of the crypto scams. We talked about like the FTX scandal, you know, this kid in the Bahamas, you know, playing video games on business calls. And so they see that and it doesn't even occur to them. Like they feel like they've already kind of done their due diligence on Bitcoin because they've read what the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal says. They've heard it on CNN or Fox. And I've seen enough of this crypto stuff to blow up to know that that's not a solution to anything. It's just a scam. What would you say, something like FTX, what can we learn from that? Or what can other outside observers learn?
Yeah, I think Michael Saylor was asked that question at some point, and his answer was pretty funny because it was so direct. But when the FTX thing like happened, I remember so clearly, it's so funny. I remember it starting. I remember it being just mania phase where it was just crazy. I remember all of those reports of Sam Bankman-Fried playing League of Legends on business calls. I mean, it was absurd. And I remember the blow up. And I remember the whole time, like, how could, you know, wealthy, impressive, prestigious people and institutions pour billions of dollars into this kid in the Bahamas with no due diligence? And these are supposed to be, you know, these are the hedge fund managers. These are the guys. These are the guys, right? If you're going to trust anyone, this is bleeding edge stuff. They're going to do their due diligence. There's no way they could burn billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars of their clients' money. There's no way they're going to let that happen. For the average person, that should have been a a gigantic, I need to find out what's going on here scenario. And to me, like what Michael Saylor was saying, that was like the perfect advertisement for Bitcoin, because the FTX thing was like everything Bitcoin isn't. And if, you know, for the average person, go kind of look up, go on Wikipedia, you know, this is kind of how it starts, is go on Wikipedia and look up the FTX collapse, and you'll see the basically like one-to-one opposite of basically the FTX scandal to Bitcoin, where Bitcoin has no person who can issue any Bitcoin to dilute the Bitcoiners. FTX didn't. FTX was basically a gigantic unregistered security, and this dude who was outside of U.S. jurisdiction was taking all of this money and started his own coin and was saying, trust me, bro, just invest in FTX, put your money on my exchange, and I swear it's there. In reality, he was gambling with it. I think he was doing options trading, that's really funny. But it was just everything that Bitcoin isn't. No one was doing any due diligence in the form of like auditing. Bitcoin's public. You can audit every transaction. If you send someone something or they send you some, if they send you something, you can audit that. You can see that it's public to everybody. It's clear as day. It's super easy. Everything about FTX was not easy, was not clear. You know, someone running it was some no-name, nobody dude from nowhere. It was red flag city. And that was like, to me, because on the news, they were painting it as, oh, this is like another blow to crypto. Well, yeah, the shitcoiner, altcoiner stuff is just nonsense. And I get, you know, to the average person, if they start looking at Bitcoin, you know, and they go download Coinbase, which is, I think, one of the first things a lot of people do. I've posted about this, but Coinbase will not stop sending me notifications to my phone. The other day I got Useless Coin as a notification on my phone. And I got, the month before, I got Fartcoin, and the next month, which was last month, I got Useless Coin. And these are like unbelievable advertisements. If you have, you know, any critical thinking skills, you will say, whoa, why? It's weird that you could buy Bitcoin and Useless Coin on the same platform. But like, should you treat them the same? Like, that's the question, you know, that an average person, you're going to be like, should I treat Fartcoin and Bitcoin the same? And then you know, that's how that mindset kind of gets evolved. So, I think the
problem is that people do treat them the same because they just bucket it into this crypto, you know, like you're absolutely right. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you understand that there's a distinction. If you've spent even just 10 hours, you understand at least there's a distinction, whether or not your faith is, you know, fully ossified in Bitcoin is another matter. But it's so evident. At the same time, I understand that people who haven't done that diligence on any level besides reading some mainstream FUD are going to just lump it all together and say, you know, that's so. How would you then maybe frame out the different, like why Bitcoin, not crypto? And maybe feel free to give your commentary on why you think Coinbase does this. I mean, I think you follow the money, but why Coinbase does what it does.
Yeah. Just real quick. I think they just have a business model, and just reading a little bit about just how they make money. I think it's 60% or something. Most of their money is made on altcoin, like altcoin transactions. So they're simply just, it's in their business model. That's all. So like, I don't know exactly, like I've listened to a lot of interviews with the dude in charge. I forget his name, but
Brian Armstrong.
Yeah, Brian Armstrong. It's hard to decipher what he really thinks. But he is running basically like an unregistered casino, and it also includes Bitcoin. That's kind of just how it is. But I think for the normal person, when they hear, oh, my whole life savings are in Bitcoin, and then they see the FTX thing and they go, oh my God, I can't put my life savings in crypto, that one blew up and all these people lost all of their money. How could you put it all in Bitcoin? I think it's just a confusion of what it is. And like the way I think that I would lay it out is I want to give people more credit. Like I was saying, I want to give people more credit. Like, hey, you're smart. You can do the research. You know, you got this. Like you got this. You're a 30-year-old. You're a 35-year-old. You're a millennial. Oh, did I lose you for a second? Oh, there we go.
Yeah, just for a moment.
Oh, just for a moment. Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah. Just what I was saying is, I would just implore people to just research something like FTX is perfect. It's like the perfect advertisement for Bitcoin. It's absolutely perfect. The whole blow up, the entire trust system, like the trust hierarchy where Bitcoin is trustless. FTX was just a trust me, bro, perfect Ponzi. It was everything Bitcoin isn't. I would seriously push people to just look at that situation and then do something very obvious. Like the Bitcoin standard is awesome. I just gave that to someone for their baby shower. The Bitcoin standard is great. There's gradually then suddenly, I think makes a lot of sense too. Parker Lewis is like, the way he articulates everything is really good because it starts from first principles. And I think if people can break those habits, those first principle habits of just trust the system, you have this adjacent system that's built very nicely. And I think that's like the way to go because people sense, I think just real quick, people sense there's something like wrong or there's something off like about the system in general. And they don't know where to direct their energy. There's a lot of energy directed at politics. There's a lot of energy directed at conspiracy theories or like, you know, stuff that's, it's like stray voltage. What is fundamental and at the center of all of that is the money is funny. The money is broken. The money is what's at the core of a lot of stuff because just real quick, money is the way in which we view value. It's how we value things. And once that medium of exchange, the way we can value something, once that begins to break and crack, you see these weird things happen. And people, you know, people start to get desperate and they wonder, you know, what's going on? Even though we know Bitcoin is the answer, weird things like the FTX blow up is perfect for someone who's very, very curious about, you know, if there's a solution out there that they can really invest into.
So we're about halfway through the show. Never too late to take a step back. And why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself? Because I want to shift topics here in a minute. But I think for people to understand why we're here, why we're talking, what some of your experiences, I think would be interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. That's where I lived my whole life. And I went to UC San Diego for school for my bachelor's. And I spent some time in Singapore, which is awesome. So I got to do their like study abroad program, which was like super instructive, really interesting. That was in 2013. And that was like definitely like a highlight of my formative years because I did that when I was 20. And then right after that, I got into actually local politics. I got into politics and I worked for a congressman. I worked for the state assembly in California. So for those who don't know, that's like the House of Representatives, but for California, it's called the Assembly. And I did that for 4 or 5 years. And then I basically just looked at, you know, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? I kind of saw politics. I went into politics not knowing it very much. And then after a couple of years, I knew a lot about politics. And I was definitely like, okay, this sort of, you got to choose, right? When, you know, I was like 24, 25, you got to choose what you're going to start doing in life. And I was like, this is something I don't want to do. I don't see much value in it. So I sort of went back to the drawing board and I was like, what did I sort of want to do in college that I was like scared of doing? And really that was computer science. And when I was in college, I didn't think I was smart enough to work on computers, to be a software engineer, to do any of that stuff. So I got my Bachelor of Arts. And that was like a massive regret for me. And so when I was looking at, you know, how should I approach, you know, software and working on computers? Where would I learn? Should I just go re-get my degree? What should I do? I was looking at the Army. So what I ended up doing was just enlisting in the Army. And I was in the Army for 7 years. I got all of those skills that I wanted. I met some awesome people. I did some awesome things. And then now I just got out and I started a small business and we're a small business that does software. So like, you know, I stuck to I stuck to learning those skills, doing the best that I could. And, you know, I'm very grateful that I got to start my own small business. And now I'm just a software engineer, trying to hire more people, doing the best I can. And, you know, now I'm a Bitcoin maximalist as well. So I'm really focused on those two things, like my business and Bitcoin. And that's like my next 10-year effort as it stands.
I love it, man. So as someone who has spent some time in both politics and the military, you time abroad, like you've got sort of an interesting perspective, I imagine. One of the topics you mentioned to me was El Salvador. And El Salvador is sort of the Bitcoin nation right now. But you posed the question, you said, well, what happens if Bukele dies? And, you know, and if Trump buys Bitcoin, will the U.S. continue to hold? You know, Germany already sold their Bitcoin. We've seen that. We've seen a couple of nations do that. Can governments be entrusted, in your view, to hold Bitcoin? And maybe just kind of give your overall stance on like this, the hot topic of SBRs and nation state adoption.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of those are better like served as questions that people should definitely consider and think about, because what El Salvador did was amazing, right? They effectively abolished murder. That's cool. That's interesting. That's never been done before that I know of. And they bought Bitcoin, that's awesome. That's a game changer. But you do have to ask the question of, what happens when Bukele dies? Is their government set up to where his son is groomed and indoctrinated in the Bitcoin mindset to take over and, continue what his dad did? That is what they did in Singapore. So Singapore runs a normal parliament democracy, the same as the UK, because it was a UK colony. So Singapore runs the same parliament system the UK does, but they have a fun, the founding father of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, sort of handed the country to his son. And his son is doing his best to uphold what his dad did. You know, is El Salvador doing that? You know, will Trump do something like that? You know, if we look at, will the U.S. government, establish, they said that they will, right? Establish a Bitcoin reserve, all this stuff. You just got to ask, like, what's going to happen in 3 years if someone else takes, what if the opposing party, what if the Democrats take over? Are they going to hold? What if a Republican takes over who doesn't care about Bitcoin or doesn't see the value in it? Or what if Bitcoin 10Xs and, you know, you have the Germany thing where they just sold it. And Germany's not some no-name country. Germany's a serious country with a serious government, and they just sold it. They didn't need to. It's just these questions that you have to ask that's along the same path as what we were talking about earlier, just trusting the system. The system, you know, being in politics, being in the military, the system is the system. You just have to respect it for what it is. It's a very cold, thing. There's not a lot of, people like to sort of humanize governments. They like to humanize El Salvador, Bukele. They're humanizing the system in a large way. Bukele is not king of El Salvador. He's not. His family doesn't rule it. His son, I assume his son's not going to take over if he dies. His family's not going to get, how in tune is his family to the system? Like, is his family going to suffer the same consequences as the average person in El Salvador if things go wrong? When things hit the fan in Syria, Assad left. I think he flew to Germany. You know what I mean? You just got to ask these questions of another thing too is with Bukele, with El Salvador and stuff like that, what is the plan here? You got to ask, what's the plan? You know, as a serious person, they have 100,000 people in jail. Awesome. They abolished murder. That's awesome. That's so awesome. What are they going to do with 100,000 people? That's like an army. He imprisoned an army. That's what he did. If they ever get loose, he essentially has an army. He's like a civil war, like a bomb. And it's the same with Bitcoin. What's the plan exactly with Trump, with buying Bitcoin. What is the U.S. government's plan to buy Bitcoin? You know, because we have Michael Saylor's, like, I don't know if you've heard his, like, Trump Max, triple Trump Max, it was from, I don't know, I think it was from Bitcoin Vegas. It was like Saylor's keynote speech or something like that. But he basically was like, hey, here's a plan. How about Trump? How about you print like 30 trillion US dollars and just buy Bitcoin? Because there's this insane first mover effect. If the US does that, the price will shoot up. The US will benefit greatly. And that can only happen so many times, right? You know, a major country can only, you know, print, you know, if the US prints 30 trillion and buys Bitcoin, there's not going to be a lot left. So there's only a couple of countries that can even do that if that starts to happen. And the US would be a big beneficiary of that. But that would require the US to have a plan. And like Michael Saylor's plan was, well, why don't we print 30 trillion, buy Bitcoin, and then basically solve like the US debt, basically get the US back to solvency, essentially. And that's a great plan. But like, again, the governments have to explain what the plan is behind these Bitcoin reserves. Everyone gets involved in the hype on Twitter and stuff like that. Oh, dude, Bitcoin's going to be awesome. They're buying Bitcoin. But like, why? Because we are buying Bitcoin. A small business is buying Bitcoin. A person's buying Bitcoin to conserve their life energy. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of questions of like, should the governments even be involved in this? Because, you know, if they're going to be reckless with Bitcoin, they're going to put even more people off. You know, Germany probably put a lot of people by selling Bitcoin. I bet you they said, oh, this is some risky, weird asset. We're just going to sell it. And they probably put a lot of people off of Bitcoin because, the German government doesn't care. So I shouldn't care either. So there's just a lot of questions surrounding that.
Yeah, I think maybe the most prudent course of action for anyone is just don't get hung up on what governments are doing. And yeah. I mean, I took the position. I was in Nashville when Trump was there, and at the time I was only 50% of the way through my journey up to this point. And so I was still early enough that I was cheering it on and I was really excited. And now I'm like the most anti SBR guy in all of Bitcoin, I think. But regardless of whether or not you think it would be useful or not for the government to buy Bitcoin, I think to be distracted by that is the signal that you need to buy Bitcoin or to sell, because that's what they're doing. That's what Germany did or what have you. I think it's just foolish. I think it goes back to the initial point you made of doing your own research and making these determinations, regardless of anything conventional wisdom says or whatever everyone else is doing. Is just do your research, figure out what makes the most sense. You will land on Bitcoin if you research diligently enough. Yeah. And just don't let Trump or Bukele or anyone else, because I think this is a question I've asked is, you know, like Bukele seems to be doing some great stuff. He made a deal with the IMF. Is that going to derail anything? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. What if he dies tomorrow? Right. You know, then what? What is the plan? And the problem is realistically in most governments today, there is no long-term plan. The plan goes as far as the next election, and people do what they need to do to optimize for financial gain, to optimize for seats in the House, Senate, whatever, you know, election they're looking at, and to preserve their legacy to some degree, I think. And outside of that, I think anticipating that there's going to be some sort of long-term plan devised that an administration from now, much less five administrations from now, can and will execute on, just feels like a fool's errand to me. And so it kind of goes back to what you said on, you've got your family, the people in your life raft. How do you keep that afloat? You know, the air you should be putting into your life raft is not government hopium. It's Bitcoin. It's health. It's, you know, education. It's all of these important things that no government's really going to help you. So I would just encourage people not to put too much weight in what governments are doing. You said you called Bitcoin life energy. Could you maybe expand upon that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I like what you said about it being kind of a fool's errand. I think that's exactly how I would categorize that. But yeah, that's part of the what is a government? What's the point of a government? What is a government's plan? You know, Bitcoin is like life energy, right? Just like I was saying before, you go on the freeway, you go to work, you are working for a wage. The entire point is to pay for your life and then save for the future. That is your life energy. You know, that's the sum total of your mind, your body, your diligence, your discipline, everything like that. And Bitcoin, you know, it's the perfect way to store your life energy because it's permissionless, because of all the things sort of we've been talking about. But people should be very diligent, but I would almost just say you got to get aggressive. Like I was saying before, you got to get aggressive. This is your life. Whether it turns out good or bad, no one really cares. Whether your family, whether your kids can look at you in 10 years and be like, that was an intelligent decision. Thank you for doing that. You know, we're safe. We're in a good spot. All of that comes down to if you can intelligently, calmly, in a disciplined way, store that life energy. And like I was saying, you can, once you start looking and thinking about this problem, you know, a lot of people start thinking about this problem when they have kids. You're going to store your energy in what? Tesla stock, bonds, gold. You know, what are you going to do? Exact cars? What are you going to do? Your house is an obvious one. But I think just very plainly, Bitcoin is that apex predator. And I I was talking to my buddy about this the other day. To millennials, Bitcoin being life energy is good, but it's also extremely dangerous because it's this massive monster. Michael Saylor calls it Godzilla, right? It's this monster. And if you're not in that, you're in its way. And Godzilla's coming. Godzilla's knocking stuff out. Godzilla's taking real estate to zero. Godzilla is taking the Mag 7, is hemorrhaging money. They're absolutely hemorrhaging money every quarter. Billions of dollars are not going to Bitcoin. They're going to shareholders and they're going to random projects and they're blowing money on the metaverse and AI. They're blowing cash. Godzilla is like coming. So although Bitcoin is absolutely an opportunity, it's very important for young people because young people have time and not a lot of opportunities. They have a lot of skepticism. Bitcoin's perfect for that individual, that millennial. Bitcoin's also super dangerous because every year that goes by, you know, it's not going to be too long to, you know, see Bitcoin at a million. And people are going to feel, the average person not in Bitcoin is going to feel weird about that. They're going to feel hopeless. When Bitcoin's at $1 million, it's going to be very weird for the average person. When Bitcoin's at $2 million or $5 million, I don't want, you know, that's like the worst thing possible, someone feeling hopeless, like they shouldn't buy Bitcoin, even though they should buy Bitcoin at a million. Absolutely. Michael Saylor, everyone in our space is like, buy Bitcoin at a million. You're fine. That's the right decision to make. The fear of not doing the right thing is going to stop a lot of people. And it's just that, look, this is the greatest way to store your life energy, even if it's at a million, even if it's at 2 million. People are going to say, oh, I missed the boat. People told me I missed the boat at 10 grand. People told me that 100%. People sold their Bitcoin. Oh, I missed the boat at 10 grand. I'm not buying. And I was like, no, please, please reconsider. Please do your own research. But it's hard to make people do something that they're not going to do. But so I would just instead sort of implore people to really think, you know, Bitcoin was at 10 grand. You know, oh, I missed the boat. Bitcoin's at 100 grand right now. Oh, I missed the boat again. Bitcoin's going to a million. You know, what is the plan for your life? You know, and that life energy is so important for people that are 30. They have a long time to live. They have a lot of years of life energy to be able to store. That's awesome if you are taking like the appropriate steps and being diligent and disciplined with it.
I like that. So I want to step back to the government question, because one of the other things you told me was that you see corporations as a natural counterweight to governments and you think that Bitcoin aligns more naturally with companies than with government. Could you maybe share what your thoughts are on that and what you mean by it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in a weird way, corporations, like companies, because they're just ways to organize people, right? Governments are a way to organize people. So is a company. You know, a mom and pop diner is a company. They're a little company and they're arranging something to, in a solvent way, serve people food and have a good experience, etc. And what that requires is long-term planning. The corporation or the company, it's just a way to organize people that makes them think about long-term planning. The government, like you were saying before, they're very focused on the next election cycle. They're sometimes focused on public opinion, sometimes focused on lobbyists, sometimes focused on nonsense. And the government can't go insolvent in a way in which the incentives would drive them to do something incredibly responsible. You know, a lot of things in government, and I was in politics, a lot of things in government, they're incentivized to do the opposite thing. And sometimes that's because it's cool to campaign on. Oftentimes it's because it's a kicking the can down the road situation. But I'll tell you something real quick. When I was in politics, one of our top priorities, you know, remember, I knew nothing. This was like 2014. I knew nothing. One of our top priorities was Social Security, Medicare entitlements. That was our top priority. And when I got reports from the GAO, which is the Government Accountability Office in Congress, no one knows about this little office unless you're like a politics nerd. There are a bunch of master's degree people, economists. They're really smart and they're dialed in people. They tell you the truth and their reports matter. Trust me, it's the GAO. 10 years ago, they were saying that the entitlement situation is like dire. And my congressman was concerned about that. Obviously, that made it so I was concerned about that. That situation hasn't been resolved at all. Like at all. That's like 12, 13 years ago. You know, 2014, 2015, 2016, the GAO was like, entitlements are they're going to like bankrupt the country. They're going to cause insolvency in some areas. It's going to cause like a seizure of the system because they're so expensive. And I just saw in January, I don't know if you've seen this, but the Treasury, along with the GAO, put out their yearly, you know, state of the government report. And they said we have about 140 to 150 trillion in unfunded liabilities. And they said in that report, it's super long. On page like 183, 2032 or 2033, so 6 to 7 years off, we will have Social Security will be first, and then that will be like 89% funded, and then Medicaid will be second, that will be like 80 something percent funded. And basically, they said the Treasury in a report in January just plainly said you have to increase taxes, cut spending, print money, or some combination of all of the above. And that's the state of play. That's not my opinion. And 10 years ago, that was not my opinion either when I was reading all these crazy reports from the GAO. That's why I say to not really focus too much on politics, because the Treasury, you can just read it. They tell you the consequences of these things being kicked down the road, and focusing on political issues sort of beyond that is a distraction from these super ultra core issues. No one's going to talk about that. No one cares. That is not a debate in Congress. And when that happens, you know, the Treasury says, well, we can raise taxes, cut spending, or print money. And that's the way it is. That's the way it is. It's super, super plain. And, you know, like I was saying before, it's 2025. It's like late in the game. We're absolutely like late in the game on this. Back then, the GAO told my congressman it was dire. They told us it was dire. fast forward 15 years, it's super, super dire. We're within 10 years of those programs are insolvent. They're going to cause massive issues. They will cause massive issues. And the government, of course, you know, if you have to predict it, they're going to take the path of least resistance. They're probably not going to cut entitlements. They'll probably say, you're going to get your check, but we're going to print money. So we're going to hollow out, you know, we're going to hollow out the cash. We're going to make it not buy so much. And they might raise taxes. Who knows? But these things are coming down the road, you know, and it's not like my opinion, and it's not very crazy. It's just happening.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'd direct anyone to Larry Lepard's The Big Print. I don't know if you've read that, Wyatt, but I think that if you're curious, the likelihood of them taking any of these different paths, I think what Wyatt's hitting on here is The Big Print, and Larry frames out his thesis quite nicely, and I think you'll be compelled to agree. Hey, let's start heading for home. So one thing that is near and dear to the hearts of us at the Bitcoin Way is self-custody. And you told me for someone in their 20s and 30s, could you maybe just explain what does it look like to hold hope in your hands with proper self-custody?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it is like, I sleep like a baby. I think that's what it comes down to is if you're just a normal person walking around, a lot of friends, a lot of people I know, it's a very cynical time. It's a very anxious time. There's a lot of uncertainty and people, you know, there's a lot of like, what do we do? There doesn't seem to be a lot of solutions kind of coming out of our leaders and, you know, tech giants and stuff like that. The ability to just take your life energy, right, and distill it into something and hold on to it and say it's like it's right there, it's on the blockchain, I can see it, it's such a weight off of my shoulders. It's like the sleeping like a baby effect. I don't worry about some political catastrophe, some disaster happening. And also too, the flip side is like, I'm really hopeful about the future. And Bitcoin, I think like just meeting people and talking with people, that's like a big contributing factor to, I think a lot of just happiness in general is like people see Bitcoin and they go, this is it. I'm very hopeful about the future. I am doing the right thing for my kids. I'm doing the right thing for my family. We're going to be okay. And I think just that happiness and that passion is so important. It's so critical. Someone that has, you know, your average person, if you told them they had like sovereignty over their money, it's not in a bank, it's not ethereally in your house or ethereally in Tesla stock because you own a part of Tesla and all this stuff, you can just hold it in your hands. I think for people that's like, that is a revolutionary idea. And I, to people who are a little bit skeptical of Bitcoin, I think just try it. I think, you know, send $1,000 to a cold wallet and just put it on the ground, put it in a safe. It's just like, it can sit next to your passport. You go, this is awesome. This is like it, you know, I can walk around with my money. It's right there. I can see it. And I just think that's an awesome revolutionary idea.
Yeah, it is. It is the revolution, really, is the ability, because it's only the censorship permissionless money that we talk about when it's in full self-custody. And, you know, we talk about this all the time here, as you can imagine, but it's not as complicated as you think. If you've never done it, it can be intimidating, but that's why we do what we do every day at the Bitcoin Way. So shameless plug, you know, check out thebitcoinway.com/podcast and schedule some time with our team. Okay, hey, we got one more question. You know, it's coming. I know what the answer is, man, and I'm nervous. Ask if this is going to be the craziest one I think I've ever had. So what's an unpopular opinion that you hold? You get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners, which you will get the most bonus points ever for this answer.
Yeah, for sure. My unpopular opinion, and oh yeah, it's going to make Bitcoiners super mad, is that Bitcoin, I think, needs to have a basically like a king, like a CEO. And I know that sounds radical, but I think, you know, we need to do something about the decision-making executive process of Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin needs a CEO. It needs to be a one-time super election of all of the coin holders who basically employ, just like a company, they just employ a person whose job it is to oversee, just like a company, just like a Fortune 500 company, it's their job to do the PR. It's their job to do the executive management. It's their job to hire people in service to coin holders for Bitcoin. It's a person in charge. And, you know, to people that are kind of skeptical of that, let me say, you know, with the Core Knots situation, all of the situations we've had in Bitcoin in general, any decision to murder Bitcoin would be a political decision. And that is why inherently you do need a leader of some kind. You know, if you look at sort of what's happening online with like the Core Knots situation right now, because it's just the hottest with Adam Back and stuff like that, it's very clear that like why, because the situation right now is we already have these unaccountable devs doing things for reasons we don't understand. There's some dev doing shitcoin stuff on the side. Very bizarre. We already are in a situation where there's an unaccountable kind of group of people in a very weird way who are supervising Bitcoin. The best way to do anything is to put a person in charge and pay them through, you know, we can pay them through the network fees or whatever, but is to pay a person who can be a like caretaker, the executive in charge. That is literally why companies do not have CEOs for no reason. And then companies don't run other things for no reason. Every company runs a shareholder CEO arrangement because that is the most efficient arrangement for human organization to get things done at all. And obviously that situation is not perfect, but the situation we have right now is super bad. It's just super stupid. Why do we, so like I put my whole life savings into Bitcoin. It is this revolutionary protocol, but we have unclear oversight. We have unclear roles. We have unclear, you know, commits to the code. It's not very clear. And I'm a big fan of formalism. I want to know who's in charge. I want to know who's to blame and who to fire when something goes wrong. I want to know who to praise when something goes right. And to everyone who's, and it's going to be probably every Bitcoiner because everyone's super libertarian, but who would they rather have in charge? Michael Saylor or kind of unaccountable whatever devs? And I think almost everyone would rather have Michael Saylor as the caretaker executive in charge of Bitcoin. He's sort of the spokesman already for Bitcoin, right? All his job would be, I'm going to decide what is good for the blockchain because the shareholders employ me and I'm at the behest of them. I'm going to do the right thing. And, you know, coin holders can fire him if they want to and replace him with someone else. We have digital keys. We have digital anonymous keys. We can do something where we can replace people because we can pay people. Guess what? We have our own network. We have our own bank. We can pay someone in Bitcoin to be the executive in charge of Bitcoin. And if we don't like them, we don't pay them in Bitcoin anymore. Fire them. We elect someone else who's the caretaker of Bitcoin. I think it might sound crazy now, but there's a lot at stake. I think in a couple of years, I've never heard of anyone sort of talk about this before. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say it, but there's just a reason that there is a shareholder CEO relationship with companies. It's because that's how humans organize. Even a mom and pop restaurant, a mom and pop is in charge of the restaurant. There's no decentralized restaurant. And it just doesn't work. Stuff doesn't work that way. Humans can't organize that way. And with Bitcoin, there's a lot at stake. And I think it would just be beneficial to every coin holder to be able to hire and fire someone to be in charge of the code. You know what I mean?
Man, I don't even know where to start with this. So first of all, to anyone listening, we at the Bitcoin Way, myself personally, we do not necessarily endorse this particular stance. It's just a fun conversation. I mean, I think the practical reality of it, just off the top of my head, because I've not given any thought to this, is we'd have a hard fork immediately. And my guess is that the side that remains unsupervised by a central authority person would be the most attractive chain. And so I think the effort would fail, even though I sympathize with what you're trying to say, is that there's a sort of a natural hierarchy that humans seek. So my guess is even if it would be optimal, which I am not suggesting it would, again, haven't thought about it, would probably be skeptical, but I don't think it would work in practice, just because I think people would opt out for like philosophical reasons. That said, the point you make that is problematic is like the way that these changes to the code are made, because it's the way I view Bitcoin is as a monetary protocol. Like Bitcoins are money. The software is a protocol, and something like, you know, SMTP for email is like there isn't an SMTP Twitter community where people are yelling at each other and screaming. It's ossified to the point now where everyone agrees what SMTP does, and there's probably updates and changes that go on in the background that I know nothing about and don't think about. I think we need to at some point get to that level of ossification where it's evident what the protocol is into the future. And I think a lot of that will come with, honestly, probably institutional and nation state adoption, even though it's not something that institutional adoption I cheer on. I'm not a big fan of the treasury companies. I don't know if you've listened to any of our stuff. Like, I don't like the fiat products that they spin up and, you know, buy my stock and that sort of thing. But I think every company should and will have a Bitcoin treasury, and hopefully they use, you know, positive cash flows and accept Bitcoin as payment and do those sorts of just basic things to accumulate that treasury. But I think once we reach some threshold of institutional and nation state adoption, the code will, yes, we'll have maintenance updates for obvious patches and those sorts of things. But by and large, I think it will ossify. And at that point, I don't think we'll need anyone in charge anyway. It'll just, having just a bunch of ragtag coders will be enough to sort of maintain the protocol. So I don't know if you have any other comment on that, but it's an interesting thought exercise. I'll say that.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm not hard stuck on that idea. Like, I'm not a hard charger. Like, I think this is the way to go, because I haven't put too much thought into it beyond just some thought exercises, because immediately you're going to say what you said, which is hard fork. It's like, that's like the no brainer. That's what's happened in the past. But so I'm not hard stuck on it, but you do see like some of the most successful open source projects, like Linux, for example, sort of ruled by like a benevolent dictator. And that's like why it's successful. But I could see it getting to an HTTPS, whatever, any of the various protocols. There's, you know, there's tons and tons of protocols which exist that are doing great, which are, you know, no one, there is no, there's nothing like I was talking about. There is no one really in charge. So they're running just fine. The internet works just fine, et cetera. But, it's definitely a problem having these weird dev issues. And, I think that sort of gives people a little bit of like, you know, like worry, like who is this person making this change? Like, why is this person proposing this change? And then like, who gave them the authority to make that change? Like these weird changes, like, or not, right? The spam wars, who's, you know, what is the right way to go or whatever. So, you know, maybe that's just the way it is. You know, maybe that's just the way it should be. I really like, Michael Saylor has talked about just how Bitcoin, one of the great things about Bitcoin is just how slow it moves, how hard it is to create consensus, how hard it is to change it. I totally agree with that. So maybe what I'm saying is maybe it doesn't make sense enough. Maybe it is the right way to make these slow, very hard to kind of capture changes. Maybe that is the way.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing, because you'll get some hate for it, but you know. That's part of sharing your opinions, man. Believe me. I appreciate the thoughts, man. Thank you for the time. This has been a fun conversation. Again, I hope this is a wake up call, because there are so many people. I'm sure you've got them in your life. I've got them in mine, who need to hear what we're saying and need to understand that there is a solution. You've heard of it before. You've just never looked into it long enough. So Wyatt, thanks for the time, man. Do you want to give a handoff, tell people where they can find you, learn more about you, follow you anywhere you want to send them?
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, it's been awesome, man. Obviously you guys can find me on Twitter, and then my company puts out open source research and stuff like that. So if you guys are interested, if you're interested in software and things like that, we have a GitHub and whatnot, but yeah, thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, of course. I'll link to that in the show notes. And Wyatt, let's stay in touch, man. This was a fun conversation. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed this conversation with Wyatt. Do me a favor, go to the show notes and check out how you can follow him and learn more about what he is working on. And of course, help us feed the algorithm. If you're enjoying the show, give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested in what we're talking about. If you need help with taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, no compromises, no shortcuts, no counterparties, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We would love to chat with you. We can also help you get set up for online privacy, help you configure a privacy phone. We have a Plan B residency option that is incredibly popular at the moment. We can also help with solo mining and a number of other Bitcoin-related services. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.